Barry, this is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is November 22nd, 1999. I'm at the University Foundation building with Joe Corey, and we're going to be concluding our interview on his involvement with academic services today. We almost finished our section on admissions last week. We ended it with talking about the possibility of academic services and units in academic services going to smaller computers, systems, and servers as opposed to ADP. And your last word was you never quite got there. Why did you not quite get there?
Well, two things. One, just the cost of going that way would have been high in when we were looking at it. It's probably come down.
Yeah, right. Initially, people have to understand computers were very expensive.
And then the other facet was the university had one of its inevitable study committees and then decided to merge Mac and ADP and look for a new director. We eventually wound up to be Mark Luker. And, you know, at that point, we were all sort of asked to kind of hold off doing anything too dramatic, and it didn't make sense to do anything that dramatic to cut ourselves off if in fact the new unit was going to be so much better and a stronger service, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Was the new unit better?
Well, by the time it came along, I was no longer in academic services, so
you must have contact with the people now. They're now. Did you? Are they in smaller servers now?
Or no, they've stayed.
They stayed with
do
it.
Yeah,
as it became known. Okay. Okay, let's move to the next unit that we're going to discuss in academic services, and that's foreign students and faculty. Let's start out again by you talking about describing the functions of the office.
Well, this is a unique, when you add the word faculty in there, you're talking about something very unique in terms of the other offices. This is the only one that really deals directly with faculty, and the way it did, of course, was to be the link between the Immigration and Naturalization Services and foreign faculty being brought in, or international faculty, we call them today, and all the various visa categories and the complexities therein. Now, those categories were different, but it made sense in that time period, perhaps, to have one office dealing with Immigration and Naturalization Service, because the students and the faculty are both governed by the Immigration and Naturalization Service in terms of the kinds of visas they get, how long they can stay, and et cetera. But the actual categories are significantly different, and so in a way there were really two significant parts to that office operation. You had the dealings with the students and their categories. That's fairly straightforward because the staff there are clearly the experts, since it involves students, people are willing to listen to that equation. On the other hand, you have high-powered faculty who have grants or who have made international contacts, and they want Professor X in here under any circumstances, regardless of what the Immigration and Naturalization Service rules are. And so there's enormous tension on that side of the equation, because you know they simply couldn't believe that if they wanted somebody they couldn't be here, that sort of thing. I mean, now I'm stating the extreme, but we just had enough of those cases so that it was much more diplomatically sensitive to deal with the faculty side of the equation. So you had to have a very good director in the office. Originally the director had been Milligan, who was a member of the faculty, and I had worked under him.
What department was he in?
He was French and Italian.
Okay.
And he retired and went on, and we started looking for, were there other faculty who would want to do this, and there weren't.
Boy, I can understand.
Yeah.
that's a difficult job.
So we wind up hiring and in fact, initially, the Foreign Students and Faculty Office, at the time of the breakup of the Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs back in the 71 period, gets transferred to the Office of International Studies under David Johnson. And after a year or two, he said, that isn't a good fit. They ought to
come over to academic services.
I think largely because of the heavy student factor there. And I think he just felt that the staff and so on would be much more comfortable. They weren't physically housed in international studies. So then the decision was made to bring him over into academic services a year or two after the academic services unit was formed.
Now, you had a couple of directors after that, a woman named Ann Corey.
Yep.
She replaced Milligan. Tell me a little bit about Ann Corey.
Well, Ann came to us from the Institute of International Education, their Chicago office. This was a IIE, as it was known, and I think it still exists, was a sort of centralizing organization for a lot of government or quasi-government activity. As students would be brought here on IIE scholarships and things like that. So they would come to the campus, IIE reps, to check on their students, how well were they doing, what kinds of things were going on, what kind of programs might a particular university have. And in the course of that, Anne, who was a Wisconsin native, made it known that, you know, she'd be looking for a job, and so she applied for and was eligible for the, or won the competition for the post at that time. She was hired before, she was hired by Dave Johnson before it was transferred over. And the only reason that's at all significant to mention in terms of timing, because you've got a question here about was she related, and the answer is yes, she's a second cousin. We never knew each other as kids, however, there was a split back in the family. We met at the IIE office in Chicago when I was working in the office of foreign students and faculty. Yeah.
How long did she remain in Madison?
Well, she's still here in Madison.
Oh, is she?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
She's married to
no
John Strasma. Huh. And she resigned ultimately to go on to law school. And then her associate director, Mike Dean, was made director. And until such time, must be about halfway through Shalala's chancellorship, that the office is split up and the faculty portion goes to the Carlo Ratz's office in Human Resources, and the student portion goes over to Mary Rouse, the Dean of Students.
Just from what you know, why did the Chancellor make that split, do you think?
I don't know the answer to that question.
That's an interesting thing. I can't figure out why. Let's talk a little bit about this immigration and naturalization. That must have become very technical and very touchy, like you said,
times. Extremely so.
Did you have a person who worked with the office? I assume it was located in Washington, D.C.?
No, there's a Milwaukee office.
Oh, there is? Okay.
Oh, yes, because Milwaukee's a port, among other things, you know. So they would come over periodically to visit with us, or if we had lined up, for instance, if the office had lined up a group of people with particular problems, then they'd come over and spend a day working on it.
Was it a fairly collegial relationship that you had?
For the most part, it was, yeah. Milligan had done a very good job of working with INS. You know, it was especially touchy when the Russian students first were allowed to come.
Oh, yes, yes.
Then you'd have not only INS, but you had the FBI and others in too, because the Russian students weren't allowed to leave campus without special permission from the State Department.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and in the early days, very, very sensitive. You had to.
This is in the early days of your tenure, like in the early 70s?
Yeah. I don't know when the change made, because I was got away from it at that point. But yeah, and it was those relationships that were frequently the office would feel would be jeopardized by faculty who were going over, you know, trying to get congressmen to get special deals cut and that sort of thing, and then the local agent gets all the pressure, and so then when he or she comes over, they're not that receptive to the 29 other problems you got, you know. So there was a lot of diplomatic work to try to carry out.
Did you, obviously the Russian thing was because of security.
Right.
Were there any ever any spy accusations, or were there ever any reasons for us to believe that they were sending over people who might have been, looking around a little bit too much?
Sure, I think that, I don't think there were any reasons as such to believe, but there was a strong feeling it would be naive to believe that there weren't. Whether it was the Russians or a number of other governments that sent people periodically.
Well, we had the same problem with the Chinese,
sure.
I think, about a decade later, and there were feelings that, you know, there
why not any more than when you and I were talking in the first session about my being perceived as a spy for the CIA when I went to Nairobi, so why?
The who's on the other should, as they like to say. All of a sudden.
Now, there's one other aspect of this office that your questions might not lead to, and I don't want to lose track of it. That's we've been blessed for years with an organization called the Friends of Foreign Students. They probably call the Friends of International Students now. Mm-hmm. Mostly women, but men and women who wanted to make foreign students feel welcome here, and they used to run a special reception center long before we did much for students, where they'd help them find housing, you know, because they couldn't make arrangements before mm-hmm. they got here, obviously. And just give them some general background on the university. And then they had a picnic every fall mm-hmm. for, they may still do that for all I know. And they would run classes for the wives, yes, let's do that, the wives in English. You know, mm. So lots of members of this organization taught spouses how to speak English and that sort of thing. It's been, and they had a special coat service.
A special what?
Coat.
For
winters.
Of course.
For winters,
yes.
And people would donate coats, and they'd make sure that foreign students got coats and stuff. So this had a public community relations mm-hmm. aspect to it that a number of our other offices didn't have as directly, and there was a lot of involvement of people. And so the directors of this office had to have, you know, they not only had the diplomatic front with the INS, as it were, to keep track, but they had a much more public Madison, Dane County kind of mm-hmm. operation than most of the other offices did. And, but it was a fantastic service. The people did a great job.
Well, I remember when I lived in Eagle Heights, I used to stand on the bus stop and take the bus in, and there was an African student who lived in the next building, and I got to know him because we stood at the bus stop every day. And I remember our first really nippy day in November. He came out and he was dressed for the biggest blizzard you've ever seen. And I remember him coming up to me and asking if it got any colder. And I had to tell him in 1 month this would feel warm. And operation coats and things like that, I'm sure, would be right. most helpful to this.
Right.
Now, you made an interesting, I'm interested in semantic distinctions. Twice you said what used to be called foreign and is now called international. Obviously there was a change. Why did the change from foreign to international?
I think foreign has become to be assumed to be pejorative, and international mm-hmm. has a certain, we're all in it
bracing.
Together kind of
yeah.
thing.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay. What about any of the other big issues that the unit faced, that foreign students and faculty, were there any other major things that either Milligan, Corey, or Dean had to face in their internships?
Well, both this office and the one we're going to talk about next were originally in Bascom Hall, and as the career advising and placement.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And as the administration grew in size in Bascom, there, you know, why not get these folks out, because students don't come to Bascom mm-hmm. that much yeah. anymore, et cetera, et cetera. So they were always fighting for space, and both of them wound up
space wars, yes.
at one point yeah. down in Science Hall.
Oh, in Science Hall. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, a little quib on the space thing. When I joined in 1971, and came back to be on Shane's staff, in either that year or the next year, Ed Young said, well, let's have a little get-together at Christmas. And we got all 30 of us in one room for a noon-hour luncheon. For, mm-hmm. Well, you can't get a single office of 30, you know, in the growth in that whole area is just so enormous of the things, all the administration required in the almost 30 years I worked there.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
Let's talk about career advising and replacement. Again, describe the functions and operations.
Well, and this one, we want to be careful that although it has a title and is in a sense an all-university office, anybody was welcome to use it, you already had special career advising and placement offices in engineering and business
mm-hmm, right.
and education and ag. And even in chemistry, for example, though the career advising and placement is largely serving LNS students, letters and science students, you also had within chemistry a more direct office,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and I'm sure in social work and places like
other departments would do the same thing, yeah.
where they had links to mm-hmm. agencies and stuff, they would do it. But the function was to, and it was a place for interviews to take place, and it's the interviews coming to this office that are the problem in part for the Dow Chemical and that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Also, it would be the LNS component. And
as well as the
business. Those are the lower campus students, and generally the students who would be more involved, who were more involved in the activity and the unrest. A couple of directors under your tenure, and the first one was Edward Weidenfeller.
Weidenfeller, right.
Do you want to talk about him, please?
Well, I've forgotten what Ed's background was. I know he was the associate under Emily Chervenik, who was the predecessor. And he had done some work in industry before he took this over. That was fairly typical. But he liked the campus life sort of thing. And he was the one responsible for having the vision for the move to Science Hall. Because the place that he had to move into in the basement used to be the old rock shop. And when we went down there to look at the space, which was, you know, wonderful because it was four or five times the space they'd had in Bascom anyway, you had to have a lot of imagination to, it was dirty, it was just full of all kinds of stuff. And that's one of the miracles of the Jim Churchill finding enough money to get a place like that cleaned up, because you don't get special money for that. You know, you get some help from the various shops and stuff. But when it was finished, it was a very nice setting. So nice, in fact, that eventually IES decided they wanted it, and you know, that office is now over in the old bank building at 905 University
Avenue. Oh, okay, I'm good,
But they did have a good run there.
Yeah.
And what was significant was that when these various industrial interviewers would come to campus, the director, when they were in Bascom, would have to go around and try and beg to find out who was going to be absent a day or whatever, anywhere in the building or wherever, to get the spot where this interviewer could stay for X number of hours. It was just, it was not a good location. It was time, you know, nobody likes to leave Bascom, the center of things. But they did have lots of nice interview rooms. That was one of the things we were able to create down in the basement.
Was there any ever any problems after the student, the Dow, and things like that with different companies coming in for interviewing?
I think there might have been one somewhere along the line, but it wasn't significant. Okay.
So the worst was definitely
worst
over.
Was
at
definitely
that point.
Over.
Now what happened to?
Periodically, the military recruiting thing would
perk
it set up, but that too was gone by the 80s.
What happened to Ed Weidenfeller?
Weidenfeller was a. In his other life outside the university, he was a devoted member, supporting member of the Madison Drummond Bugle Corps, the Scouts. And they were off on a trip in the West someplace when he suffered a heart attack and died.
How old was he? About
45, I think.
Yikes. He was followed by Tom S. Johnson.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, he wasn't immediately. I want to pause there a minute because with him dying, it was about a four-person office, and the most experienced person was actually the secretary of the office, Francis Sundin. And the other person, I can't even tell you who it was now, was part-time, the other academic staff person. We persuaded Franny to take the responsibility, and she was probably, that should kill me, but she was probably 60 years old at the time. So, you know, it wasn't an easy thing. It wasn't the thing she had trained for. But she did a wonderful job as acting until we could recruit and then bring in Tom Johnson.
Where did you bring Tom in from?
He was with one of the advertising firms in Chicago, and he had come here several times interviewing, and like many people, the Lorelei syndrome of Madison.
Yes, there's something about this
town. If there was ever a chance to do it, and when he saw the ad in the Chronicle, he put his name in the file and came on top, and then he stayed until, he's just retired 2 years now, I think.
So. And he still lives in Madison?
No, he's moved to Florida.
What about his tenure? Any major issues come to a point, or?
No, I think the thing to say about this office is they're arranging interviews and doing what counseling they can, but it never got beyond a three- or four-person office. And so it was always a case where students had to really take the initiative to come and you know, we tried to get information out. Obviously, they were better prepared than if they wait till their second semester of their senior year and then start worrying about a job, if they've done some thinking ahead. And there's much more of that now than there used to be. I mean, there's so much more of a career orientation, I think, with, but lots of young people entered LNS.
Yeah, I'll bet that's a different office now that you mention it.
Yeah.
More students were just going to school to learn LNS.
Yeah,
and,
you know, something would come along.
Something would come along, and now it's much more focused. Yeah, I suspect that would be interesting to interview someone like Tom Johnson on that change. And then they eventually went into LNS.
After my time.
That was after your time. So did you see that coming as a possibility? Were you surprised when it happened?
No, it's always been a possibility if LNS wanted to, broaden its responsibility for this to have, because as we talked about earlier, the other colleges
And the other colleges often, like engineering, for example, you had a natural base for jobs out there. You had Cutler Hammer, you had Oscar Mayer.
And you had companies that only come to engineering or only come to business. They weren't interested in LNS.
That's right. And it would seem to me, from my ignorant point of view, that LNS would probably need career advising more than some of the other colleges.
Well,
even perhaps.
I think that that's now that's seen as a, and obviously the link, if it works, though, they're still physically separate.
Mm-hmm.
If you had your college advising group talking more with your career advising mm-hmm. people, mm-hmm. you'd be in better shape.
Mm-hmm.
How much of that goes on, I don't know. Mm-hmm. You may also recall, having done your grad work here, that if you wanted to, you went to the education placement office because you could get two or three letters from your major professors and you had a file. So that was for master's and PhD mm-hmm. candidates. So that was open to anybody. And I can remember when I finished my master's, I had, letters placed in the file over there, that sort mm-hmm. of thing, which isn't a bad idea in case your major professor dies or...
That's right. And you also had the opportunity, at least in my day, to meet Bob Heidemann and to be encouraged by him
right.
and supported by him, and
right.
that was
right.
Most helpful. Which leads me to one other question. Was there a lot of interaction between these different placement offices, between Bob's educational placement and the engineering placement and the LNS career advisor?
They had a placement coordination council that they had for themselves. This the sort of informal thing the university has always encouraged, mm-hmm.
Feel
free to get together if you've mm-hmm. got a common interest sort of thing. If we went back and looked in the committee record book for various years, we might find it listed there as an official thing, but it ebbed and flowed a lot depending on the individuals who were directors of the various shops over the years mm-hmm. and what their interests were in sitting down and getting together. But to some extent there's coordination among mm-hmm. them.
Let's look for just a few moments at some of the committee work that you were involved with while you were administrator for academic services. We've mentioned the Registration and Records Committee earlier in this interview. Are there any others that you would like to discuss?
Well, just briefly to mention that at various times there were concerns about enrollment. We're part of a system now.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the enrollment curve has not been one of steady up,
mm-hmm.
somewhere in this
right.
period, I'd have to go back and look, there actually is a... the first peak of the baby boom and then a slight falling off before the echo effect comes along. And so students become something of a precious commodity because the fees you get from the system, the amount of state fees you're allowed to get depend to some extent on your enrollment. So system is always trying to monitor this between the various mm-hmm. campuses. And so periodically they'd say, well, we need a study. And so then UW Madison would have to make sure it had a comparable mm-hmm. group to feed the one or two people who would serve on that. And I served on a number of those enrollment management committees, if you want to call that, over the years. There's always been a somewhat difference of opinion. Faculty, by and large, would probably have... preferred to have fewer freshmen and sophomores here and more upperclassmen.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, the administration would look at it and say, we can't survive without the freshmen and sophomores, particularly if we're going to fund graduate students for the teaching assistants and that. So you have this intertwining of the whole business there. And one other aspect of this that's kind of interesting, Don Percy, who was a creative vice president in system, tried a three-level scheme. As you may know, we've had undergraduate fees and graduate fees. But for probably about a four-year period in the late 70s, we had freshman-sophomore fees and junior-senior fees and then graduate fees.
Jeez, I had no idea. Yeah. Who paid the least and the
well, the freshmen paid the least and then the junior-seniors paid more. And, yeah.
And why did Percy come up with that and what happened to it?
Well, I'm sure it was a creative, I mean, always the argument was, what's the level of financing the state's going to give you? And you know, there's been that argument for years about whether the state has supported one-third of the cost, and it's down to 25% of the cost now. I mean, there's been that kind of an attrition in the amount per student that the state contributes on the front end. But the I suspect, you know, it'll be worth, probably somebody in the system will go back and look at it, I'm sure, that this was just another way to convince the legislature that there were costs. For instance, at the junior-senior level, you had to have smaller classes and to be more specialized, and therefore that cost more. And would the legislature give us more if the state, if the university charged more? And my guess is that probably after the four-year period, it was pretty clear that the state wasn't going to give any more, and it was a lot simpler just to maintain
the basic
undergraduate versus graduate.
But there's an interesting ramification to the deal, because you got this additional funding when people got to be a junior. Well, in a 120 credit degree program, where would you assume somebody was normally a junior?
60 credit 61 on.
You're right. But, you know, we're not so slow. We made it 54. And that's why you have 24 as the freshman year thing, and 54, you justified it on the basis of, well, they shouldn't have to work quite so hard in their freshman year.
Yeah.
So 24 credits would be good products, and then of course you shouldn't take more than 30, so that gives you 54. Yeah. And so then you're really a junior, because by then you should be able to. And of course that was tied into the registration priorities and other things too, you know, because you registered seniors, juniors.
Yes, so, of course. You go through.
So,
How many credits did it take to graduate? I've forgotten.
120 is the minimum.
120.
And, some of the schools had higher tolls.
How quickly we forget.
But even the students in those schools were juniors at 54.
That's interesting. Let's look at an overview of academic services. You were in charge of all these different units that we've been discussing, new students, foreign students, career advising, placement registrar, et cetera. Did you ever have regular staff meetings that included the heads of all of these different groups?
Oh, yes, sure. We met monthly.
What were you likely to talk about?
Well, you know, in any second year, you're starting to talk about budget preparation.
Yeah.
And this is a period where one of the things systems tried out was things called decision item narratives.
Oh, these are the DINs.
DINs,
yes.
DINs,
I've heard a lot about DINs. I still don't understand them.
Well,
the truth.
All they are is a proposal. It's just a name for, you know, you make a decision item on the basis of the narrative. You make a decision on the basis of the narrative that's presented. Well, they would suggest certain categories. But, you know, there wasn't a biennial budget that would go by that we wouldn't have been remiss if we hadn't tried to justify something in terms of needs. We were always understaffed, always could use more computer help or whatever the case might be. And so we would get together and say, what's the most attractive DIN we could create as a group? And, you know, can we get in together to do it? And so during biennial budget years, that's the kind of thing you'd talk about. We would spend time talking a lot about staff morale. I mentioned earlier about the fact that upward mobility is very restricted for people in these areas, and how do we reward them? And then in some part in there, I've forgotten now whether it was right about 80 or something, the Hayes Hill Mm-hmm. You run across that. Yeah, there's this big study, and everybody in the academic staff is put in a category.
Right.
And, of course, that took several years to fuss about what categories these people would be put in, because it made a whole lot of difference in at least what their salary potential would be.
Potential, right.
And that part of the idea was that would create some ladders, and to some extent that's been true within, but not anywhere near as much. It also had a very high penalty factor in it, that if you got to the top of the range, even if there was a 5% salary, for some reason the system thought it was appropriate that the top of the range only went up 3% if the salary went up 5% on average across. So if you were already at the top of the range, you automatically were penalized no matter how good an employee you were. Because you couldn't get more than 3 unless you could find justification to leap into the next category.
Not always easy to do.
No, not by a long shot. So, and then we would have to talk.
You talk about your computer support. And
yeah, and you know, there's also a phenomena of, in terms of director's morale, there's all these people, by the time we get into the 80s, are housed outside of Bascom. And there's a feeling that in order to be part of the team, they need to know what's going on in Bascom.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the jobs of Jim myself was to, in effect, be open and share as much as we knew about what the Chancellor and Vice Chancellor were thinking about. And as insignificant as that may sound to somebody, that's very important to morale in the long run, and then how they go back and these directors and translate that to their own staff. And of course, if you had the forum, you could also bring the Vice Chancellor in periodically to meet with the group.
In my discussion with, I believe it was Wally Dalma, he said that one of the very helpful things you did was to provide them essentially access to the to what was going on in Bascom Hill. So at least in his mind, it was certainly not a small thing.
Yeah,
he understood. He said almost exactly the same way you did it, except from the other end. And he said that was most helpful because, he didn't say this, but I can see you are sort of sitting in the dark. You're in the basement of Science Hall, and you're trying to figure out if...
Or you're in those tiny cubicles on the third floor of the university club, and there's no air conditioning in the summer, and the federal guidelines aren't out yet, and students will be here in 6 weeks, and you know.
Fortunately, it never gets hot and humid in Madison, so.
No.
Was there ever any friction between the different units? Sort of jealousies or anything like that? Somebody was getting more attention or more money?
Well, I'd be the last person to know that, I guess.
So you never saw that, didn't you? Okay. You worked for three different people during the course of your service in this area, Irv Shane, Bri Curl, and Bernie Cohen. Talk about the three of them. How were they to work for? How much did they get involved in the issues of the different units, or how much hands-off were they?
Well, Irv got involved a great deal right at the outset. I mean, I was one of his first staff people when he became vice chancellor. And when I was hired, I was hired as an assistant too. I had no line authority, and it was only, you know, after I'd been there a while that the academic service thing was created, and then so within a year or two, you know, he was focusing, as he and I developed a relationship of trust, he would focus elsewhere, and it was just up to me in the vice chancellor staff meetings to make sure that academic services needs and inquiries and other things were appropriately represented.
Then you got, how did Bri get into taking over from Irv?
Well, I just want to say one more thing about Irv first.
That's,
Irv was a walking calculator. He never read a budget figure that he didn't remember from any detail.
He knew where every nickel is, is what I've heard.
And you know, you had to be extraordinarily well prepared when you were presenting him with the budget deal, because he wasn't going to put up with anything that was shading the figures at all. So I think that was a great baptism for Jim and me in learning how to go about this kind of thing. And he also reminded me that with the competition, I know at one point we knew of an individual who had a second income, and I was inclined to make a decision for a little less salary for that individual because it wasn't enough to go around and give more to the other. He said, now, wait a minute, you've got to be funding the position for where the position ought to be and the responsibilities connected therein, and that's what we as the university should be paying for. And I thought that was an important lesson that, that I kept the rest of my time in place. Berg would also, any drafts of anything that you sent in to him for policy statements, or so he couldn't keep his hands off, he edited them to beat the band. In that sense, he's also very much like Bry. Bry was a great he was an ag journalist background, and so he was a great editor. We often joked, not so much about what we were doing in academic services as such, but if, let's say, we would be developing something that was going to be a campus-wide policy coming out of the provost's office, we always wanted to go back, and we never did. We'd sometimes go have so many drafts of the thing, and Bry's marking kind of pencil, I'm not sure that's the right term, but you know, the big heavy ink thing would flow all over these documents. And we were sure, and it, apocryphally at least, that if we had 8 or 9 revisions or more, if we went back, we'd probably find him putting back what he had originally edited out in the first vision, you know, that.
But then it would be his idea.
Yes, of course. Right. So those were sort of heavy duty editors that I worked for on that side of things. I think Bry was coming out of ag journalism and having had a lot of ag faculty far more sensitive to the politics of the state than the sort of traditional L&S faculty would be. I mean, the whole business of ag, the way it tied in, the cooperative extension influence, all of that sort of thing. So almost everything we did with Bry had that sort of how does it play in Shawano or Keewascom or something like that.
Or down the street.
Yeah. But I mean, with a much more feel for the whole
the politics
state.
of the situation.
And he'd been here longer and all the rest of it. But as far as feeling supported, all three of these people were very strong in their support of what we were doing. Now, by the time Bernie comes in, Bernie had been a department chair and an associate dean in the grad school, but he did not have, at that point, and I'll say this right, but I've got more experience than he does in a lot of this area, so the relationship changes, but a superb, superb individual to work for, just a delight. And maybe I learned enough by the editing training I'd had from Irv and Bry to write better memos, but I didn't get back so many with overwrites on them under Bry.
When did Cohen take over?
I would have to go back to our sheet here, wouldn't we? About 84, maybe, something like that, is that right?
I can't remember.
Yeah, it's got to be 84 because Bry retires as vice chancellor because that's when they have this punitive.
The age thing.
Right. At 62, you actually lose if you stay in administration at that point, and he becomes dean where they don't have the rule of dean of university outreach.
Shane talked about that in his interview about why he did that and how it came about.
Bernie will be in about 4 years, and then he's got that 1 year as acting chancellor, and then comes back for one more year.
Looking at your service as administrator for academic services for those how many years? 15?
Something like that.
What were the major changes that took place in academic services during your administration?
Well, I think a greater reliance on the computer. In other words, we substituted.
Yeah, you were there at a crucial. That was the switchover time, 71 to 86.
Whereas before we would have filled. Tried to fill needs with positions. We had neither the space nor the money, or the position authority. You know, by then the university system and the state government had imposed position authority, so you had to
justify even a new position all the way down. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one of the trends that is there. There's a lot of work gets done by computers, and we talked briefly before about Wally Dalma's shop being about half of those of the others in the Big Ten in terms of personnel.
Right. Yeah, that's
and yet sometimes even far, far bigger in terms of the dollars handled, especially on the loan side. Mm-hmm.
Any other major changes?
Well, I think that the part of the change is this. There was this euphoric expectation in the late 60s that higher education was just going to expand forever, you know, mm-hmm. and the Madison campus would mm-hmm. not only have 40,000 here, but 20,000 out on the Charmany Farms and that sort of thing. And so, you know, if you just hung around, there'd be plenty of jobs to go. Mm-hmm. So keeping an eye on morale when that boom
When did that boom bust?
Well, I would say by the time of the end of the Vietnam War, it's really...
Did the student uprisings have anything to do with the end of it, do you think?
No, I was putting more of a timing factor on it. I think for a while there were some parents who would send students elsewhere mm-hmm. during that period, but then mergers, timing-wise, is right there in that same thing too, and so you're bound to have more interest. You now have University of Wisconsin Whitewater. It's not just Whitewater State teachers anymore.
That's right.
That's been good, I think, for the state overall. I mean, how much more could we have grown in this narrow little isthmus that mm-hmm. we're trapped mm-hmm. in here?
What do you feel personally was your biggest accomplishment as Director of Academic Services?
Oh, gosh.
Anything that you have that you can look back and say, this is what I'm really most glad that I did? Or
well, I think it was encouraging the directors to be in charge of their shops and to give as much possible authority in within their shops to others, at least. You know, if we couldn't give upward mobility, let's at least give people a feeling that they're making a significant contribution.
Is there anything, looking back, that you do differently at this point? Or at that point? This is one of these interviewer questions that I always feel compelled to ask.
I think, I would have liked to have spent more time on the relationships with the high schools. We are one of the areas where there is a large interface between admissions and new student services. We did do some programs as a program we didn't talk about where through Blair, when Blair was working up in Bascom,
Blair Matthews,
we started using the computer to analyze the various high schools. In terms of how their freshmen did here. Now, we had to be very careful. They had to arrive at some statistical number that was a minimum, because otherwise, if the school only sent one student mm-hmm. in a year and you're giving them a report, they're able to identify who the student was, and this is the period when the Buckley Amendment comes through, and you've got to protect the student's rights, the privacy, right? And I think if we could have done more in that area, eventually that too got controversial. I don't remember the reasons now why, but it always was a two-edged sword, in the sense that if you clearly had high school X, whose people were always doing well here on average, mm-hmm. and high school Y, where they weren't doing well, you'd have one group of faculty who would say, well, then we must never take anybody from Y. And that was against the notion of if you're in the top X percent, regardless of Wisconsin high school. So I know there was a potential for a lot of divisiveness in that, but I would have liked to have thought that there would have been, if we'd had enough time to look at it, we might have been able to give mm-hmm. a kind of feedback to say, hey, you're doing great, except your math people really need to, exactly how we do it, of course, without causing a problem for the school district is another question.
Well, the other interesting thing that comes out of that is you're talking about something, some computer research that you were thinking of doing, and you were just at the cutting edge of that. It was just starting. Mm-hmm. Probably it would be easier to get some of that research going. I'm not counting the privacy rules and everything, but just from a technical standpoint.
Absolutely.
As opposed to back then, I can still remember those old Wang cards or whatever those things were and all that. It was a real effort to do stuff. It's not like today and not like it'll be 30 years from now when somebody's listening
to
this.
Well, and as you know, the difference is we had to rely completely on our relationship with ADP to get that data.
That's right. So you were at their mercy in it.
Right.
And this is almost...
So that even though data is maintained centrally today, you can bring the pieces of that program you need down onto your PC to do it. So individuals working for us could have done that data, could do it now if we were still interested in doing that.
Okay, that will conclude our section on academic services. I'll be coming back to Joe and we'll be continuing with the next phase of his multifaceted career. End of interview.